This is another segment in our Great Investor Series, and I'm very happy to welcome Monish Prabrai as my guest today. Monish began his investing career in 1999 after he sold his business and he discovered the work of Warren Buffett and Charlie Munger. I'll let him tell it, but suffice to say, Monish's investment fund has crushed the return of the S&P 500 since its beginning, and he's considered one of the world's greatest investors. Hi, Monish. Welcome to my show. Appreciate you being on.
Steve, pleasure to be with you.
You know, you started very untraditionally. You were not trained as an investment professional. You owned your own firm in IT. And so how did you actually begin your investment career?
Well, you know, it started in 94. I was 30 years old. And quite by accident, I actually just heard about Warren Buffett. And I was lucky because the first couple of biographies on him had just come out, you know, Lowenstein's biography and also a couple of others. And I found those very intriguing. That led me to the Berkshire Hathaway shareholder letters, and it just opened up a whole new world. And what I realized at the time, and, you know, I was an outsider looking into this industry, is that Warren was all about what Einstein called the eighth wonder of the world. He called compounding the eighth wonder of the world. Mm-hmm. And Warren knew very early on that he was going to be very rich because of the unusual powers of compounding, especially when you have long runways and high rates of return. And so I thought that it was worth giving it a shot to start my own compounding engine, if you will, mm-hmm. and to see where it could go. So I had a little bit of money saved up for my IT firm, and I decided I would, you know, try to apply Buffett's approach to investing on my own portfolio and see what I could make of it. And that did quite well. I think we were doing north of, this is in the mid-90s, you know, north of 60, 70% a year.
Was that mostly from tailwinds of the time? Or because I would think when you first start out, you'd be making some serious mistakes.
You know, basically, the core premise that I took from Buffett at the time was he has a saying, I'm a better investor because I'm a businessman, mm-hmm. and I'm a better businessman because I'm an investor. So one of the things I've actually used for the entire 22 years that I've been doing investing is I've never thought of buying a stock as a piece of paper.
Yeah,
I've always thought of it as buying a fraction of a business, mm-hmm. and I've approached it as if I would buy the entire business. So if a company has, say, for example, a market cap of $500 million, the question I ask myself is, if my family had $2 billion, would we put one-fourth of the family assets into this business?
Right.
And if the answer to that is yes, then, you know, usually I'll proceed with buying the stock. But I never look at, oh, it's a $25 stock, I think it's going to go to 40 or something like that. Yeah. I don't think of it like that. I think of it as ownership stakes in businesses. And that type of thinking of ownership stakes in businesses, what I found was unusual in Warren, because most mutual fund investors at the time had such rapid turnover, owned, you know, scores of stocks. You know, a typical mutual fund would have 50 or 100 stocks. And, you know, they're just dancing in and out of these positions.
Yeah.
So they didn't really think of it as, in my opinion, ownership of businesses. And in that period, I had a lot of learning looking back to do, but these core principles, which is buying a dollar for well under a dollar, and looking for businesses that are within circle of competence and thinking of them as businesses, stood me in good stead. And yes, because I had a tech background at that time in the mid-90s, my portfolio was biased towards technology because that's what I understood the best.
Yeah.
And we did really well on a number of them because, you know, I just understood the businesses mm-hmm. better than most analysts would.
Yeah, but I think I saw an interview where you said you don't invest in technology because you understand technology.
That is correct. So I'll give you an example of kind of how I leveraged my knowledge. So one of the first investments I made when Prabrai Fund started in 99, in fact, I think this was on the first day the fund started, July 1st, 99, was a bank in Silicon Valley called Silicon Valley Bank. Mm-hmm. And they still exist. I think the ticker is SVB or something. And they are a very well-run bank. and very prudent in their lending. But the one unusual aspect of them was that any time they had any type of loans or, you know, credit facilities that they granted to their account holders, and all their account holders were venture-backed companies. They were mostly venture-backed startups and such,
right,
or more mature technology companies. So what they would do is anytime they gave a line of credit, they would attach warrants to it. So they would take warrants from the company,
mm-hmm,
in addition to the usual interest spread and all of that.
So it was a proxy for you. I guess it was a proxy as well.
So basically what happened is that Silicon Valley Bank had warrants on thousands of internet companies,
yeah,
and they had no disclosure on exactly what and how much they owned, just that they had this practice. And the bank itself was trading at modestly above book. So I bought the bank understanding that there was a moonshot,
yeah,
if these things took off, but I wasn't paying for it. So it was an upside without downside.
Yeah, I want to get to that. I want to get to that upside, downside part of your investing strategy, because one of the things that you said that really interested me was people think that as you are an entrepreneur and that you knew how to take risk and you were comfortable with risk. And I think you basically said the opposite, that an entrepreneur really is uncomfortable with risk and actually runs a business that is as low risk as possible, but has the highest potential rewards. Take us through that a bit.
Yeah, so that's right. It's a misnomer that entrepreneurs take risk. Entrepreneurs try very hard to minimize risk. So, you know, we have to separate startups into two different buckets, the venture-backed startups and the non-venture-backed startups. So venture-backed startups are less than 0.1% of all startups, maybe 0.01%. So we can ignore those. Non-venture-backed startups, which is what I'm talking about, which is the bulk of it, what entrepreneurs do is they are arbitrage players. So they look for offering gaps. So let's say there's a new town just coming up and there's no barbershops.
Yeah.
So someone's going to look at that and say, well, you know, I can open a barbershop, or I have a barbershop in a neighboring town. I'll set up a couple of chairs for a couple of days a week and see how it goes.
Yeah.
And once I have the traffic, I'll expand it. So they'll kind of always look at how do I step my toe in the water and how do I get this going without taking a lot of risk.
Mm-hmm.
And if you study the great entrepreneurs, you study Richard Branson or Lakshmi Mittal or the Patels with their motels and so on,
mm-hmm,
which I talked about in my book, you'll find repeatedly there's a common thread, which is they have embedded upside without much downside.
Well, you know, one of your initial influences as I researched about you was the Poor Charlie's Almanac by Peter Kaufman. And you mentioned that Kaufman said to Buffett and to Charlie Munger, his partner, there were three reasons why he thought they were successful. I'd like to go through those if I can. The first one is the willingness to be extremely patient. Tell us about that.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, you know, Charlie says that we don't make money when you buy stocks, and we don't make money when we sell stocks. We make money by being patient. And he associates it to being like a man with a spear looking to spear a salmon, and he stands by the river,
mm-hmm,
and it may be several hours till a juicy salmon goes by, but you're patient. So it's extreme patience coupled with extreme decisiveness. So you're willing to wait a long time for a fat pitch, but when it comes along, you're willing to bet heavily if it warrants that. So extreme patience with extreme decisiveness are two out of those three characteristics.
Well, you know, you mentioned that it's not just being patient, but you have to find bliss in while you're being patient. This has to be part of your kind of mental, emotional structure, and not everybody's wired like that.
That's right. So, you know, if you're in anguish trying to, you know, clone Charlie's model, saying, oh, Charlie said I have to be patient, therefore I should be patient,
mm-hmm,
and you're not in a nirvana state, then it doesn't work.
Mm-hmm.
So in many ways, I would say investing as a discipline fits for a certain type of personality,
yeah,
and probably doesn't fit for a different, let's say, hyperactive type of personality. So
right.
if a hyperactive trader tried to adopt Charlie's model, number one, they'd probably be miserable. And secondly, even if they tried to do it, they'd probably be unsuccessful at adopting that model.
In 2007, you won the bid to have lunch with Warren Buffett, which you shared with Guy Speer, who's been on my show a number of times. And one discussion you had with Warren during that period of time, I think, points to this third attribute that Peter Kaufman from the Poor Charlie's Almanac said. You talked a lot about integrity in your discussion with Warren Buffett at that lunch. And Warren talked about the internal yardstick, and he quoted this funny story. He said, you know, would you prefer to be the greatest lover in the world and known as the worst? Or would you prefer to be the worst lover in the world and known as the greatest? And he said, if you answer that correctly, then you have the right internal yardstick. So the third point from Peter Kaufman and in Poor Charlie's Almanac was having no concerns about being different from the crowd or caring what the crowd thinks.
That's correct. And I think that is still true with Warren and Charlie today. They don't pay much attention to what we would consider either acceptable investments or acceptable behavior. They measure themselves by what Warren would call an inner scorecard.
Yeah.
And I think that was one of the most important takeaways I got from that lunch is, you know, Warren has talked about the inner scorecard quite a bit, but what that lunch did for me, it calibrated for me how important it was for him amongst the number of things that he values really highly. So obviously integrity is really high on Warren's list, truthfulness is very high on Warren's list, and the inner scorecard, which is you measure yourself based on your internal assessments of what happened and not based on what the world is telling you has happened or patting you on the back and such. So I found the inner scorecard is a wonderful mental model for most individuals to have in their repertoire, and I think it's a great way to live your life, is measure yourself based on the internals because you have all the facts.
Yes.
Whereas the world many times doesn't have all the facts.
Mm-hmm. And to trust yourself in what you know and make sure that you obviously do the work and you have it structured, but once you know, then trust your own instincts.
That's correct. Yeah. So like, I think the Peter Kaufman, I think he hit it on the head where he said, you know, extreme patience,
yeah,
extreme decisiveness, and then be a willingness to be different from the crowd. And in all three cases, to be of a personality type that none of that bothers you. They just come naturally to your personality.
To find out more about Monish and to hear this interview again, don't forget always to join our conversation at stevepomerantz.com. where you can hear this interview again, and we'll, of course, have a written summary and transcripts of this. So, Monish, the skills needed for an investor to be successful, to understand a business, the temperament someone needs to succeed in investing, you know, when you think of all of the abilities that it takes to be a successful investor, both technical and emotional, how should the average investor invest in the stock market?
The best approach is to buy into a low-cost index fund and dollar-cost average. And, you know, so taking a step back, it is, in my opinion, relatively easy to get rich. But it does require certain deliberate actions. So the first action is, right from the time you enter the workforce, let's say in your early 20s, always consistently spend less than you earn. It's very critical to spend less than you earn, especially in the very early years when you're 22, 23, 24 years old. And, you know, take advantage of the tax laws, IRAs, 401ks, employer matches, mm-hmm. and all of that. Yeah. Max that out.
Right.
And all those options allow you to invest in low-cost index funds like the S&P 500 and so on. And dollar-cost average that in throughout your life. And even at very modest annual returns and very modest savings rates, you will end up solidly in the seven figures when you hit your, you know, late 60s, early 70s.
Yeah.
And how simple is that?
Well, you know, it's simple, but most people don't do it. Actually, they stay away because the markets are bad and there's a lot of talk in the media about this stock or that stock or how dangerous it is or maybe upcoming crash because something's going to happen. I mean, there's so much out there.
Yeah, and it's not only that investors hurt themselves with these type of decisions. I think one study found that the average size of a 401k of a person in his 50s or 60s mm-hmm. is less than six figures.
Yeah.
And what that means is that either people are not putting the money in that they should, which is really lost money because you've got employer matches.
Yeah.
The second is that when they switch jobs, they are taking distributions. And that is one of the worst things you can do because you're paying taxes and penalties. So a simple thing is never, ever borrow against a 401k, never, ever liquidate it, always roll it into an IRA, always roll it into a low-cost index fund, and then don't worry about the ups and downs of the market. Just ride it out.
And actually, when you're accumulating money, the downs are your friend. You want the markets to be low. And only you want them basically to be high when you're ready to start taking some income from them.
That's correct. So we shouldn't really concern ourselves with the vagaries of the market. The markets mm-hmm. are going to do their thing.
Yeah.
The key is the length of the runway, start in your 20s, mm-hmm. and the amount of money you put away. The annual rate of return does matter, but it becomes less relevant if you are very good about the first two
That's
factors.
Right. Well, it's the consistency that really matters. My guest, Monish Prabhai, one of the most successful investors today. Very honored that you would spend some time with us today, Monish. And if you want to hear this conversation again, don't forget to join us at stevepomerantz.com. Monish, thank you so much for spending your time with us.
Oh, it was a pleasure, Steve.